Good morning. Welcome to the Bulwark Podcast. I'm not Charlie Sykes. I'm Bill Kristol, pinch hitting for him here on July 6th, right after the long July 4th weekend. I think Charlie will be back tomorrow, but I'm very pleased to be joined today by Mona Charon, who obviously is an experienced podcaster on her own. So we'll do our best to make up for the absence of Charlie, right, Mona?
We can't possibly really substitute for Charlie. We can only do our best. I feel like a pirate. You know, we've hijacked the Bulwark Podcast, but we'll do our best, Bill, our humble best to.
That's very polite. This is Mona, so much more polite than I am. Of course, has to pretend that kind of deference, but nonetheless, of course, you yourself, such an important podcast host. So I think we'll have a good discussion. Mona, did you have a nice July 4th?
Yes, very nice July 4th. It doesn't quite these days have the feeling that it had when in past years, where it was very apolitical. We live in Northern Virginia, and I always enjoyed the fact that when you went out to the local fireworks, we didn't go into the city because we didn't want to deal with the crowds on the mall. But we'd go to our local July 4th, and it was so great because people of all types and all political persuasions, you know, were joined in this ritual, in this civic ritual, and it was a very uniting feeling. And now, unfortunately, everything has been so poisoned by partisanship that, the very act of displaying the flag or not displaying the flag and how you celebrate the holiday. I do remember with amusement that Trump, wanted military parades and all of this, it has infected it to some degree. It has spoiled it to some degree, but I try to, be positive and think, that most people, I suspect, still want it to be a kind of civic religion that we celebrate and we unite on that day, I hope.
Yeah, I was struck. I can't tell sort of how much of the crazed partisanship and picking at every aspect of it and making the flag a partisan matter, and then the size of the flag you display, and then, of course, everything else that goes with it, the history. How much of that is sort of a Twitter phenomenon, or at least an online phenomenon, or an anti-Trump partisan phenomenon, and 90% of America is going, enjoying local fireworks the way they did for the last 30 years and having picnics with family and barbecues and so forth. But I don't know, unfortunately, I wish I could say with confidence that this is just a tiny sliver and the rest of America's ignoring that, but it doesn't quite feel that way, does it?
No, and here's what I would say. I would say both things are probably true. There are still probably broad swaths of the country that do still want to celebrate and do celebrate the holiday in the traditional way and with the traditional sensibility, but there is definitely a larger and larger slice of the country that is getting meaner and nastier and more hateful. And you see it all the time. I see it in my local listserv, for the neighborhood, which is normally, like maybe we can have trash day moved one day for, the holiday, or, please pick up your dog poop or whatever. But lately, and I've noticed a real change over the last few years. The politics is intruding. People are being rude to one another. It's infiltrating really everywhere, and not all the time, mind you. But it's there and it's noticeable.
Yeah, I was very struck that along those lines too. So it's not. I mean, of course, there have always been people on the quite far left who didn't like, what July 4th was celebrating, didn't like America in a sense, or at least wanted to debunk aspects of it, which is natural to some degree. And then, of course, I suppose the same on the far right way back when, though not much in our lifetime, I would say, on the right, since the right was pretty, from Reagan on, pretty pro-American, but until recently. It isn't just a few academics and so forth and troublemakers on Twitter. I mean, the governor of a state, Kristi Noem, the governor of South Dakota, but certainly a likely presidential candidate in 2024, couldn't resist on July 4th tweeting out photos of, July 4th under Trump, great big fireworks over Mount Rushmore, and then July 4th, as you put it, I think it was, under Biden, her family somehow with one sparkler, and that just shows how much things have gone downhill. Now, it turns out, I believe, that the photo she tweeted out was not from the Trump. It's a composite photo a photographer did. He explains it on his own blog. He's not deceiving anyone of sort of putting fireworks over Mount Rushmore, what it would look like if you did that. And he did it, I think, 5 years ago or something, or maybe more, when President Obama was president. So the whole thing is a kind of comedy of errors and misinformation. Mm-hmm. But it's interesting that if you're running for the Republican nomination for 2024, you want to make your political points on July 4th. You don't want to give voters the sense that, you know what, you're the kind of person who puts politics aside on July 4th.
Yeah. You know, there's a good piece in The Bulwark today, actually, called The Paradox of Trumpist Patriotism by Joshua Tate, in which he sort of examines the views of some of the Trumpist intellectuals, if you can call them that, but who he says, look, these people do not like half of America. They claim to be, you know, flag-waving patriots, but they hate most America, or a majority of Americans who voted for Biden. That's how they define it. And that's a very new thing on the right, but it is I recommend the piece, Paradox of Trumpist Patriotism.
No, it's a good piece. Again, look, conservatism, like all points of view, has always had been critical of aspects of whatever country it's located in. And conservatives certainly were critical of a lot of recent developments. And by recent, I mean decades ago in American history, and sometimes going back even further. And that's all fine. But you're right. It's one thing to say, you know, I think progressivism is problematic, or FDR did some things in the New Deal he shouldn't have done, or, you know, I don't like the Great Society. I mean, that's more the normal political or certain cultural and educational changes, or maybe for the worse. But yes, the thoroughgoing hatred, resentment, bitterness at the country they're living in. Now, look, people are entitled to dislike the country they're living in. They're entitled to emigrate, for that matter. They're entitled to say it should be fundamentally changed. And in some countries, if we found ourselves in them, we would want to fundamentally change the way they're governed. But it's a little hard then to say, but I love this country right now. I mean, you can't. How do you love the country if you don't love its the real existing country, to use a Cold War phrase, and also if you don't love the principles on which it's based? So you're debunking liberal in the classic liberal sense principles, and you kind of loathe the country that's been built on those principles. But then you're the real patriot. I think that's the.
Right.
It is kind of problematic.
You've put your finger on it. That's the thing. It's that some of these Trumpist intellectuals are rejecting the Enlightenment principles upon which the country was founded. And people like Adrian Vermeule, Patrick Deneen, they are not just saying, look, we object to the excesses of the progressives and the woke, you know, sensibility. They're saying the whole experiment with small L liberalism has been a failure. And they want something. I mean, what their alternative is, they're not really all that specific about, but, you know, there really aren't too many other options that preserve freedom, right? I mean, you can have an authoritarian regime, but what do you want? You want a monarchy? But they are saying that they have really decided that liberalism itself is a failed experiment. So that's a profoundly radical critique, I would say.
Yeah, I mean, it's been a Marxist critique for a long time, and that's fine. But then the Marxists occasionally for polemical reasons, but don't then claim to be the most patriotic Americans. They also go around debunking the kind of traditional patriotism. What's most striking about the Trumpist effort is the, on the political side at least, is the kind of hatred of the country in some respects and disdain for it, combined with not just patriotism, but hyper-nationalism. That's the other thing, the kind of reification, if that's the right word, of the flag and of the oath. And I mean, these are all things I like and have never, you know, I've always stood for the, obviously for the flag and for the oath and even, you know, the Star Spangled, I mean, and I really do like the Star Spangled Banner, even studied a little bit the history of those things, which I think they're kind of interesting, the way American patriotism is different from a lot of old world patriotism and so forth. But they are the degree now of kind of, I don't even know what to call it, piety is even too weak. You know what I mean? It's worship of these seculars, what ultimately are obviously symbols of a nation, and people are entitled to point out their history and criticize them if they wish. But you can't say a word, right? I mean, it's
they bring a certain truculence to it, which I find incredibly off-putting. You know, this sort of chest thumping, and any criticism of the country is regarded as treason. And it's stupid. I recoil from that kind of thing, though. I've always considered myself to be a patriot, but the nationalism is, with its hostility to others and its eagerness to blame immigrants and, minorities and people from, countries, for our problems, that's just ignorant and demagogic and ugly.
And the anti-intellectualism, I mean, it's the Pledge of Allegiance. It's kind of interesting, actually. It was invented by a sort of Christian socialist type in the late 19th century.
Is that right?
Yeah, Francis Bellamy. Post-Civil War, obviously, and always with an edge towards a kind of, we're one nation. So a kind of, anti-Confederate side to it, although mm-hmm. after the fact, mm-hmm. but also a kind of communitarianism, you might say, ahead of time, liberty and justice for all, but kind of a critique of the current order. That was how she understood it, I believe. And then it was changed over the years. Eisenhower added Under God, and Congress mm-hmm. did at his urging in 1954 at the height of the Cold War. And we were, and so these are kind of interesting historical little studies one can make about American political culture, civic culture. But again, this the anti-intellectualism of the rights, if you say something like that, it's kind of ironic that you're making the pledge such a big deal. Maybe, we didn't have the pledge for all of American history. But no, you can't even, it's sort of, there's such a discouragement, if that's the word, of intellectual inquiry into our own country's history and origins, an inquiry that ultimately I think would make people more attached, not less attached to America. But that they are not very interested in that kind of inquiry, I think.
Well, my feeling is that you should always tell the truth and about your country. Most countries don't, by the way. Most countries sort of instill some myths to their young, and that's, I guess, normal to a degree. But look, I think we have a duty to tell the truth about our country so that you don't wind up with young people sort of being disillusioned when they find out the truth, right? I mean, it's better to give the whole story and say, look, we have our flaws and we've committed crimes in our history, and what we did with stealing the land of Native Americans and breaking our promises to them, and how badly we treated African Americans. I mean, all those things have to be part of the story, but they're not the whole story, and that's where we come into conflict with the 1619 Project, that tends to want to make that the center of the story, whereas I think it's maybe 45% of the story, but not the whole thing, right? And so if you have a policy of grappling with your history, it shows your bona fides, right? That you're trying to live up to the ideals of the founders, that you're trying to make it a more perfect union, and that's the best that any humans can do. But lying is never, or whitewashing is not the way to get there.
Yes, and just in the context of not lying, I said Francis Bellamy, and somehow my mind flashed to the fact that Francis is these days normally a female name, and so I said she, I think, a few minutes ago, and Francis Bellamy was a he. He was a male Christian minister. I'm not sure how many female ones there were at the time, but in any case, but then yes, he did. He was a Christian socialist type who wrote the pledge, and I think 1892 or something like that. Mm. But so your man J.D. Vance, I believe you wrote an excellent piece about him about 2-3 months ago, has announced his Ohio Senate candidacy and trying to be Trumpier than the other crazed Trumpy Ohio Republican Senate candidates. I mean, I thought Josh Mandel had sort of secured the niche there, but maybe he has. Maybe J.D. is just going to be one step over. But say a word about him, his intellectual development over the last political development over the last 5, 6, 7 years.
Yeah. So there have been so many people over the last 5 years who have been disappointing, deeply disappointing. And unfortunately, he's one of them. I was somebody who found his book, Hillbilly Elegy, quite impressive. I interviewed him on my last podcast that I used to do with Jay Nordlinger, and was a really good discussion. I I reviewed and praised the book in National Review. He brought, you know, his own experience, I'd say, growing up in a kind of dysfunctional, rural-ish, white family. He brought that perspective and talked about what I saw as, you know, and some necessary truth telling, you know, that there's a real problem with drug abuse. There's a real problem with family breakdown. His mother had, I think he said something like 14 husbands and boyfriends, you know, during his growing up years. That was really a terrible thing. And she was also an addict. Anyway, he bursts on the scene. A lot of people, and I plead guilty to, I did too. We praised his book. By the way, when he first debuted, he was very clear that he found Trump to be a very destructive force on people like his family that you know, were supporting him. And he thought that Trump was very bad for America. And he said that explicitly. But of course, after a while, I don't know exactly how it all happened, but I suspect that it was because he kept being invited on shows to talk about what the Trump people were thinking, because he was supposedly the spokesperson for the white working class, you know, and I guess he sort of slipped into becoming an explainer for why people like Trump to being a defender of the whole thing. And now he has gone all the way. I mean, his Twitter feed, I don't know if you, I mean, he recently decided to delete the tweets where he had said he voted for Evan McMullen in 2016. He has issued abject apologies about his anti-Trump comments from 2016. And he's even, and I commented on this on Twitter at the time, you know, he's even gone to the point of lending credence to QAnon types, in an effort to ingratiate himself with the Trump right. And, it's just, he's a really smart guy. He certainly knows better, but he has decided that this is the road to success in today's Republican Party, in today's conservative world. And it's really sad. You know, he's going to join, you said it's Seth Mandel, right?
Josh Mandel.
Josh Mandel in Ohio, who also, you know, he was somebody, he was a normal sort of right of center Republican. I remember meeting him many years ago, totally normal guy. Now he's burning masks on Twitter to signal, you know, these stupid gestures, you know, to show that he's down with the culture war, you know, and that's where we are.
No, it's depressing. I mean, JD, I knew really well, but some, we had dinner and stuff in 2016. He was in Washington a fair amount at that point. And then he moved out to Ohio, where he'd grown up at least partly, and obviously began to look at the political future, which is fine. But he found it was unsustainable to be anti-Trump, obviously. And I do think this is a kind of phenomenon that happens, that someone like J.D. Vance, who's an intelligent guy, it's hard to just tell yourself, look, I have to make some accommodations, but I'm not going to go all the way. I'm not going to really, because it's an awkward position to be in. You can be in it for weeks or months. You can be in it if you're a business person and you're just saying, you know what, I just want to get along with Trump. He'll be good for me for 4 years. I hope I'm not going to stick my head up one way or the other. But if you're going to run for office, you kind of have to take a position. And plus, if you're smart and intellectual, you sort of want to rationalize what you're doing. And I do think some of the more intellectual types have therefore become the most committed to kind of Trumpism. They're not just sort of putting up with Trump for the time being. You know, Mitch McConnell doesn't care, and he's, and
right.
I don't approve of what he's done, but I mean, he's in a way hasn't gone as far. And J.D. Vance, who's a lot more interested in sort of, I would say, the sort of deeper questions about America and you know, capitalism and so forth, and might have led to a productive discussion about the ways we need to moderate sort of pure free market capitalism, has just gone, as you say, the apology is distasteful for me and sad, really sad.
Yeah.
But, you know, he was a shrewd analyst of Trump, as you suggested. I just came across something he wrote, tweeted, I think, in 2016. I think this was even after the election. So I was on a panel with him, I remember, after the election, and he was still anti-Trump at that point, having not voted for Trump. And he, JD said, Trump is cultural heroin. He makes he makes some feel better for a bit, but he cannot fix what ails them. And one day they'll realize it. Ugh. And I think it's a shrewd, you know, metaphor, as it were, right? I mean, it sort of gives you that temporary high of we're all in the, we're fighting against all these things that are allegedly persecuting us and holding us down, making us unhappy. But of course, it isn't the real things. And it's a false high, a false solidarity almost. And Trump's taking advantage of you, just the way the heroin dealer's taking advantage of the addicts. But now JD has decided he, you know, there are enough of them, I suppose, that he wants to join them. I'm sure he's convinced himself of it. I don't think he's being dishonest, but it's...
Well, he's become a dealer.
Yeah. No, it's... And the whole... So much of the Republican Party, right? And Mandel, I knew. I saw he was criticized somewhere because I actually... I don't really remember this very well, but I think I even did a little event for him, kind of a, you know, a quasi-fundraiser way back in 2010 or 2012 when he was running maybe for the first time for treasurer in 2010 or of Ohio or Senate in 2012. And he was, as you say, a totally, he had served in the military and he was an impressive young man and seemed like a very sensible center-right type who had a sort of more young person. I was always encouraged to see young people, especially young veterans, get into politics. And I mean, and same with JD, obviously. And it is pretty, one part of his book that I found very interesting was the extent to which the military provided his road out of the kind of mess he found himself in
absolutely.
In Appalachia and his way to then to college and then to Yale Law School. And I remember at the time, we had a panel and I remember saying, isn't one of the best possible jobs programs, not just jobs, but best kind of anti-poverty programs we could have, was just to expand the size of the military, really. I mean, truthfully, though, take a ton of people like J.D. Vance, and obviously he's a very talented guy, so he's not quite, you know, maybe your average person, but a lot of other people could learn skills and discipline and end up being fine. And
right. So let's explain what he talked about in the book, because it's really interesting. I mean, you know, he said only when he reached the military, did he learn some basics of self-control, right? You know, like how to, you know, like get up at the same time every day, make your bed, you know, take care of your hygiene, balance your checkbook, not get taken in by scams, you know, eat healthy. I mean, all of these sort of life skills that, because he grew up in such chaotic circumstances, he never learned. And those are obviously things that are going to stand you in good stead your whole life. Obviously, they're not, they don't immunize you against becoming a Trumpist troll, but they do help you in other ways. And it helped him to then, you know, he's also obviously a very bright guy and he was able to finish college and, you know, after that in record time and then get admitted to Yale Law and so forth. But anyway, those basic skills, you know, are very critical to human capital, as the economists say. And it would be great if we did a better job of instilling those, I mean, in our families and in our communities. But since we're failing at that, you know, maybe a larger military might not be a bad idea. I'm also, for what it's worth, I'm very much interested in the idea of national service. I know for a while, conservatives were opposed to it because this, you know, they felt like, well, as, you know, kind of a, there's a libertarian critique, you know, you don't want to force people to do something. But when you consider that one of our greatest challenges right now as a country is this bitter polarization and the fact that we do not meet people who are different from us and from different parts of the country and from different socioeconomic strata, it really does seem more and more attractive to me, the idea that, you know, young people would spend a year or 2 years doing some form of national service. I mean, and being introduced to different parts of the country and different kinds of Americans.
No, I tend to agree with that. It's interesting, speaking of the military, how much, of course, the Trumpism has now become anti the U.S. military because the U.S. military is accommodating to some degree some of these criticisms of American the American past and even the American present, and trying to make sure that they're reflected, at least that the soldiers and Marines and airmen and all of them know about them and maybe understand that argument, even if they don't ultimately agree with it. And that's, of course, been understood to be, you know, indoctrination of the military with critical race theory. And I think J.D. Vance has joined in that attack, especially on the top brass. And I was talking with our friend Eric Edelman about this over the weekend. He's been your guest on Beg to Differ pretty recently, I think, right?
Yeah.
And
then
also,
oh, yeah. He's
also
wonderful.
In this podcast on Charlie's, served at number three at the Defense Department under Don Rumsfeld, actually, and then Bob Gates. And I mean, and stayed very close touch with many, many, he was a Foreign Service officer himself, but very close touch with the military. And this attack on the military is not just, you know, a lot of people who are anti-Trumpist, both on the left and our world, have sort of said, oh, look how, you know, can you believe it? Now they're attacking the military. I'm old enough to remember when conservatives generally tried to defend the military and thought it was, on the whole, a good thing and a force for good in the world and in America itself. But it's really beyond that now, because there really is an attempt to foster dissent and division in the ranks, not a kind of healthy criticism of the brass and maybe this particular, you know, decision is a bad one or this chairman isn't the best ever. That God knows it's a free country. We're entitled to criticize military officers like everyone else. But it's not that. It's really an attempt to, I think, to lay a groundwork for a very dangerous sort of politicization of the military from top to bottom. I mean, you read those tweets of Trump and his supporters. I mean, they're laying the groundwork for, if one of them becomes president in 2024, firing several of the chiefs at the beginning of 2025 and putting in political loyalists and taking much more control of the promotion process and really encouraging, therefore, people who want to make it up in that particular administration to be Trumpist and to sound Trumpist. And this is a path towards real dangerous authoritarianism. We've seen this around the world over centuries, millennia, I suppose, right?
Right.
A politicized, and one of the great achievements of America has been a pretty rigorous non-politicization of the military. Truman famously fired MacArthur in 51, I guess it was. You know, I mean, this sort of, we've been pretty careful to try to avoid that, not perfectly, but pretty, and done a pretty good job of it, so that you didn't think if you were an officer, you had to have certain views or you had to cater not just maybe to your immediate boss, everyone has to do that a little, but to the kind of the party that's in power. And I mean, I think this assault on the military and especially the kind of demagogic attacks on appeals to kind of junior officers to dislike their seniors because they're allegedly doing all these bad things, it's very dangerous, really.
I could not agree more. I mean, the Trumpist movement, and it is just Trump, it's all of the people who are participating in this, has been like a corrosive acid wearing away at, I mean, not that faith in institutions was particularly robust even before they began their demolition effort, but they have really sought to undermine confidence in all institutions, whether it's, you know, the intelligence community, the press, the courts, and now the really fantastic nonpartisan election infrastructure that we have all over this country, which, you know, year in and year out has done great work. All these wonderful volunteers, you know, giving their time to make sure that the votes are counted in a fair and nonpartisan way. They're attacking that. They're attacking confidence in the impartiality of elections, and now they're attacking the military. The military is one of the institutions in America that still has broad respect by the American people. And sure enough, you know, the Trumpists are going after that.
No, I mean, it would have been a different story over the last 4 years if we didn't have a military that had a lot of internal rules and regulations and norms and customs that made it resistant to politicization both ways, actually. I mean, they obeyed orders from their civilian superiors who were appointed by President Trump. They obeyed orders from their military superiors who incidentally were appointed by President Trump, General Milley being the most recent, not the most recent, but the most highest ranking, I suppose, when Trump made him chairman of the chiefs. And but they also, you know, wouldn't just because Trump, I've always cited this as an example, Trump at one point tweeted, I guess, in his attempt to, you know, win favor with parts of the religious conservative movement, something about I'm reversing all this transgender stuff. They're all fired from the military. Do you remember this vaguely in 2017? And, you know, Jim Mattis was Secretary of Defense, and they did nothing for a day and then said, look, we have all kinds of procedures for separating people from the military if they deserve to be self-separated, but also we don't remove people from the military if they don't deserve to be separated. Right. You know, they signed up for their 3 or 4 years or whatever, and that this is the way it works, and there are procedures if someone has to be removed, but you can't just have a, you know, I'm taking this class of people and kicking them out if they were admitted under, you know, honest, in an honest way and so forth. So it was a very healthy moment, I thought, where we saw it's not a government at the whim of one person or one set of people sitting around the White House having, you know, ideas about what kind of military they'd like to have. And I mean, but you see this depressing. No, I'm just, it's depressing to see how much people think that's sort of a legitimate way to think about our armed forces. You mentioned the election officials. I think that's worth discussing a bit. You've written about that here at the Bulwark, and the different attempts to restrict voting rights or make them, burden them, I guess maybe is a better way to put it, to make them more burdensome for some people to exercise. And then, of course, the attempts to lay the groundwork for possibly overturning or overruling what the voters do and overruling the election officials who stood up to political pressure in 2020. And as a result of being targeted both politically, electorally, and also in terms of this legislation,
Also personally,
it's really remarkable. Yeah. So our friends over at the Republican Accountability Project, and I guess I'm one of them, so I'm double-hatted here, but starting the Republicans for Voting Rights, which will be announced today, actually. The spokespeople for it will be Olivia Troy and Amanda Carpenter. It's a board with Michael Steele and others and Linda Chavez, actually, so a lot of friends of ours. But a real attempt to say this should be a bipartisan. We can differ on many provisions and how long the early voting should be and, you know, all kinds of rules and regulations. But fundamentally, preserving a reasonably open, successful voting system, which led to a massive turnout in 2020 and almost no irregularities, and preserving a system where the votes are counted appropriately and fairly and recounted if need be, and where election officials have protections against harassment and against sort of being, you know, ridiculous kind of lawsuit. If something goes wrong for a day and before it's fixed, they get sued under some of these laws. And then protecting the overall system against state legislators just deciding they want to overturn election results, all of that is at risk. And this is something that the Republicans for Voting Rights is going to try to join in making this a bipartisan effort at the state level, at the federal level, and in terms of also elections, where as you say, these people are being, these election officials are both being harassed, but also actually targeted in primaries. I mean, that's a pretty dangerous, I mean, no, you can cherry pick any one of these things if you want to minimize the danger and say, oh, well, this particular thing is not going to end the country if we make it harder to, you know, have to put your social security number on a absentee ballot or something. And that's fair enough. But the complex of things is a pretty coordinated effort to politicize an election system that, though, since it's federal, you know, it's kind of rickety and sort of idiosyncratic in lots of ways and is different in different states, has ultimately ended up serving the country pretty well. Anyway, but you've written about this a fair amount.
So what worries me is really the, so all of these state laws, and there are hundreds of them that are either have passed or are being considered, are fundamentally ratifying the big lie, right? That we had fraud in 2020, and therefore we need laws to guard against that happening again. So that's a problem. But a lot of the measures are not really that big a deal. As you say, you know, you have to put in your social security number when you ask for an absentee ballot or whatever. I mean, I don't regard those as the biggest threat to democracy, or, you know, and sometimes people have complained about trivial things like not being able to give water to people as they wait in line. You know, that's really not an earth-shattering matter. But what is worrisome is that the Republicans have shown a willingness to disregard the will of the voters and to attempt to steal an election. You know, there are Raffensperger's sin, as in the eyes of the Trumpists, is that he would not find 11,780 votes or wherever it was in Georgia for Trump. And so what I'm concerned about is this possibility that in 2024, if the Republicans have taken the Congress, that or the House at least, that they will decline to certify the fair result of a 2024 election. And so the Electoral Count Act, this old, ridiculous, horribly written monstrosity from 1887 that governs a lot of this about how the votes are actually counted, really needs to be the focus of attention, it seems to me, not so much, you know, the vote casting as the vote counting. And that's where the sensibility of the Republicans is so dangerous. So, for example, under the Electoral Count Act, it allows state legislatures to say, if an election is close, to just sort of substitute a slate of electors of their choosing. Well, that all of our elections are close these days. And so that's an open invitation to fraud right there. Also, under this law, it just requires one member of Congress and one senator to object to the counting of any state's right. slate, which is crazy. I mean, that can be changed, and so forth. So there are a number of things that could be done to reform this piece of federal legislation, you know, and I would hope to see the Democrats focus on that. There's been a lot more attention to it sort of journalistically. I'm not sure if anything is really moving on the Hill.
Yeah, no, I'm struck that, I mean, Susan asked me this over the weekend. Actually, it was, you know, I think you need to both protect vote casting, but vote counting is maybe even a more vulnerability the way our system is set up, at least. And it's something that unambiguously can be protected at the federal level because the Electoral Count Act is the law of Congress.
Yes.
So, but then there are other things, too, in addition to the Electoral Count Act that could be done to help at the state level by sort of insulating some of these election officials from, you know, harassment and so
Absolutely.
Forth.
Absolutely.
And yeah. There has been less attention to that, it seems to me. And Susan asked, is anyone doing anything about that? Shouldn't the new version of the Manchin voting rights bill, whatever it is, which incorporates aspects of H.R. 1 and of H.R. 4, the John Lewis bill, also incorporate that? And I think they should. And I agree with you. People sort of, when you make the argument, they say, yeah, that's a good idea. I'm not so certain. I don't know why they're reluctant to add this. If they're going to pass a sort of secure the vote bill, why they wouldn't want to have this as part of it. Maybe they think it's very complicated to modify a over century old act. But no, that was I think we should keep hammering at that. And I'm going to actually, one thing I think we'll do with the Republicans for voting rights is try to make a little more of this argument as opposed to dwelling excessively perhaps on some of the provisions in the state laws that aren't as nearly as damaging or manageable, let's say. You can still have a fair election with a...
But when you think about Manchin's objections to H.R. 1, for example, I mean, what he objected to was that it was this huge grab bag of various reforms, many of which had very little to do with actual voting.
Right.
But it would, you know, if Republicans are going to say that they are opposed to a reform that would make sure that state legislatures cannot change the electoral count, the electoral college casted votes based on their state's, how their state popular vote went. If Republicans are going to say they're opposed to that, they're going to have to justify it,
you know? Right, right.
And so I just think that this would be the kind of thing that would appeal to Manchin. It would appeal to, you know, at least a significant number of Republican senators. I could be wrong about that, but I would think, you know, that a good number. So I don't know. It just strikes me as harder to filibuster this kind of reform that simply requires that the will of the people be enacted. Than some of these other wish list things that the Democrats had been focused on. Not that all the elements of the Democrats' bills were bad. A lot of them were good. But you know, it was overly broad.
Agreed. And they're aware of this, and I think hopefully they'll move on this as they sort of reassemble. I guess they just felt they had the groups, the interest groups, the not-for-profit world of voting rights and campaign reform, it worked, and ethics, it worked a long time on HR1. They put together this coalition that had the support of every House Democrat. I can sort of see that they wanted to play it out. They felt they owed it in a way to these people who had worked so hard. And some of the ideas, in my view, were kind of foolish, but public financing of contributions mm-hmm. to federal campaigns of under $200 at a 6-to-1 match. I mean, it would have provided more taxpayer money for Marjorie Taylor Greene than for any other member of Congress. She probably has the most contributions. And it's, and anyway, it's solving a problem that isn't clearly a problem anymore. I don't believe that that there's not enough money for, you know, insurgents, quite the contrary.
Yes.
Anyway, so they but hopefully now that they've gone through this, the bill didn't obviously get, it got 50 votes, but it's going nowhere in the Senate. Manchin's made clear he's not going to break the filibuster for that. Getting a really targeted Voting Rights Act that includes, as you say, not just the voting rights side of it, but the kind of honoring the votes that have been cast and ensuring that they're counted correctly and also reported and they're not overturned, then clarifying mm-hmm. the Electoral Count Act. That would be, it seems to me, the way to go. So hopefully after this little push we've given on this podcast, maybe this
there
will
we go.
happen. And of course, Republicans for Voting Rights is going to be working on this. If people are interested in Republicans for Voting Rights, I'll just make this one pitch. You can go to the website and take a look at accountability.gop/RVR. So that's the project of the Republican Accountability Project. We should close here, but let's, we were talking about TV shows recently, and you shocked me by saying I was going to my usual, what British police shows have you been watching? And you said, well, you know, there are TV shows other than British police TV shows. I was actually somewhat shocked by this. So please feel free to elaborate, you know.
So, you know, if murder and kidnapping, you know, is what you're interested in, there's a lot to choose from out there. And I've seen some of those, you know, Broadchurch was really good, but I've also found a bunch of others. I found a lot of the war ones have been great. There's Charité. Charité is a German, I think it's a German show. It's about a hospital in Berlin. So there's one series, one season is about the hospital in the 19th century, you know, when they're, I think, just discovering various kinds of medical breakthroughs. Anyway, that's kind of, it's very well done. Then they have Charité at War, the same hospital. By the way, it still exists. This hospital still in Berlin is during the Nazi era and very, very well done. Also loved the Weissensee Saga, which is, again, German. This is based in the Cold War, and it follows a family. The father is an officer in the Stasi. Wow. And it's fabulous. It's just a great, great series, and certainly something that doesn't get enough dramatic treatment, in my opinion. So I loved that. Just thought I'd recommend it.
No, that's great. Well, I'm sort of stuck in my rut watching Unforgotten, which is a good British series starring Nicola Walker, I think her name is, who's a very good actress. And
she is, yeah.
And then I guess Silent Witness, which I guess has been on for literally 20 years, and in Great Britain.
Really?
It's sort of their Law and Order, I'm going to say. I mean,
okay.
It does have the angle of being like Unforgotten, actually, often hinges on a long ago crime where they discover the body and, you know, and then they do certain things, and then it turns out that's the silent witness, I guess, is the, you know, what the forensic pathologists discover mm-hmm. from the body, either long ago or not. Unforgotten is about long ago crimes and then you discover a whole chain of things that happened afterwards that have been sort of covered over. But anyway, we've enjoyed those. But now I'm going to broaden my horizons and watch German shows and hospital shows and Stasi shows. And it's good. It shows that we're not just all in one tiny rut here at the Bulwark, you know?
Excellent. Okay.
Mona, thank you for taking the time this morning. Thank you all for joining us on the Bulwark Podcast. And Charlie Sykes will be back tomorrow. I've enjoyed this conversation with Mona, and I hope you have as well. Thank you.